Hello, good evening and welcome, distinguished guests, colleagues, friends, ladies and gentlemen. It's a huge pleasure for me to stand here and introduce our distinguished speaker for this evening. But let me take a little step back and introduce myself first. My name is Thandabantu Nhlapo, a deputy vice chancellor here at the University of Cape Town, standing in tonight for the vice chancellor who is on annual leave. And it gives me a great deal of pleasure indeed to be the one to do the introductions for this vice chancellor's open lecture. It's part of a series. And the vice chancellor, when he revived this idea, had this thought that in addition to various other kinds of forum that we have for sharing knowledge, information, exciting developments, not only with the university community, but with the general public as well, a further one that would be directly under the auspices of the Vice Chancellor's office, a further forum, was required, and this is it. It is where UCT takes a great deal of pleasure and is honored to play host to some of the greatest thinkers, innovators, researchers in the world. And for an audience that is not necessarily purely academic. And so that is why we have at these occasions everybody, including large sections of the general public. That is for one of the reasons why I'm very pleased to see that you've all come in very large numbers indeed. This is very gratifying. It appears that Professor Barrow is not new to UCT, and that in fact he delivered a public talk on cosmology at UCT 15 years ago at a conference organized to celebrate the 60th birthday of his good friend George here in front of us, Professor George Ellis of UCT's Department of Mathematics and Applied Mathematics, now, of course, Emeritus Professor. So, Professor Barrow, welcome again. It is not only that occasion, but Professor Barrow has, in fact, very strong links with UCT. I toyed with the idea of going through Professor Barrow's CV. I eventually discarded the idea, not just because it would take us into a time when, if the lights go off again, this would be close to dawn. So he does indeed need no introduction, very eminent scholar indeed. Professor Barrow, it is my great pleasure to invite you to address us. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Vice-Chancellor, for your introduction, which was wonderfully brief, and I'm very grateful for that. Well, my aim this evening is to try and tell you something about the ideas of modern cosmology, the development of modern cosmology, and what's going on in the study of the universe today. This is a subject where South African astronomers are currently playing a major role and are gearing up to play an even more major role in the future in terms of various exciting facilities which are going to be opening up and giving new access to the southern sky. Now, the study of the universe for thousands of years revolved around the idea that the universe of space was rather like this tabletop or a theatrical stage. It was absolutely fixed and unmovable, and nothing that happened on it the motions of the stars and planets and other heavenly bodies could have any effect upon it at all. But in 1915, 100 years next year from that great date, Einstein introduced a new theory of gravitation that completely transformed our conception of space. It was no longer a fixed static stage upon which things moved and interacted with one another according to different forces of nature, but space itself became a dynamic stage. It could change and respond and govern the motion and interaction of objects upon it. And from Einstein's theory, other people were able to predict that they expected that the state of space on large scale should be in a state of overall change. In 1928 to 1929, the famous American astronomer Edwin Hubble, together with Milton Humason, first began to interpret data and gather data to provide evidence for what became known as the expansion of the universe. I think there's a good argument that this was the most spectacular discovery of the whole of 20th century science, the discovery that the entire universe, everything there is in a state of overall expansion. In this picture here is a little plot of Hubble's original data. It stretches out, you see, a distance of 2 megaparsecs. That's a sort of little more than about 2 million light years. And the data has probably quite large errors, much larger than these points. But it led people to believe that there was indeed a systematic expansion of the universe. If one moves towards the present and looks at contemporary data, here's a representation of some of it. Here's the 2 megaparsecs down here that Hubble's original data fitted into, just a single spot. So just to show you how hard people work in astronomy, you can now build detectors that can see out nearly 400 megaparsecs, 400 million parsecs. And these data points of different objects again trace this fairly convincing linear straight line. In the last 14 or 15 years, there's been a Nobel Prize winning discovery that we'll return to at the end that takes seriously these deviations from the straight line at the end, that shows us that in the recent past, astronomically speaking, a few billion years in the past, the expansion of the universe has been speeding up. So what did Hubble do to make this insight, as it were? Well, what he did was to look at light coming from stars in distant galaxies. And he looked at the shifting, the measurement of the spectral wavelengths or frequencies of different colours of light. And he noticed that there was a systematic shifting in the colours compared with the same light vibrational lines here in the laboratory, and interpreted that shift as a Doppler shift. That is, the shift was telling you that the source of those light waves was receding away from us, because the shift was towards the red end of the optical spectrum. So any source of waves, if it's emitted by a source that's moving away or coming towards us, will have a frequency shift. If you stand by the side of the road, or you just try to get sleep at night while someone is driving a motorbike past your window at high speed, you know what the noise sounds like. It's sort of eow, eow. So the first rising part of that sound is where the sound waves from the motorbike are coming towards you, the source is moving towards you, and you receive the waves more frequently than they were emitted. So the pitch rises. But when it goes past you, the pitch drops, because the source of the sound waves is now moving away from you, and you receive them less frequently than they were emitted. So if you measure the change in sound frequency, you can work out the speed of the motorbike, as the police know. So what Hubble was doing, in effect, was doing the same thing, but using light, and looking at the change in the colour to figure out the speed of recession of the distant source of light, and then you use the apparent brightness of objects where you believe you know something about their intrinsic brightness to figure out how far away they are. Well, it's all very well to say the universe is expanding, but let's ask some very basic questions. What does that mean? Are you expanding? Probably not. Well, not for these reasons. Is the Earth expanding? No, the Earth is not expanding. Is the solar system expanding? No. Is our galaxy expanding? No. Is our local group of galaxies expanding? No. All those objects are held together by other forces. In the case of you or me, it's chemical forces. In the case of the Earth, it's local gravitational forces that are much, much stronger than the force governing the expansion over that distance. So you have to keep going out to the scale of great clusters of galaxies containing hundreds and thousands of members before you find the markers which are tracing out the expansion of the universe. So in Eddington's famous image, if you put currants in some dough and put it in the oven and rise, let the temperature go up and the dough rises, the currants will move away from one another. They won't expand, but the dough in between will. So the currents are like great clusters of galaxies tracing out the overall expansion. Well, this expansion, you might be tempted to think of as rather like an explosion, and your next question is usually, well, where's the centre? Or what's it expanding into? Well, this isn't an explosion. The universe is everything that there is. There's no outside the universe for it to expand into. So how could that conceivably be? Well, there's two situations to think about. The first is where the universe is infinite, which is actually easier. Here's a famous Dutch engraving, a sort of premature celebration of expected Dutch success in the World Cup final on Sunday. So this beautiful Escher picture of this network of girders is designed to create a perspective picture of a never-ending network in three dimensions. And if you were to stand on any one of these intersections and look around you, it would look the same in every direction. There's no edge because it's unending. If you were to raise the temperature of the environment, the metal girders would expand, and you would see this one expanding away from this one and away from that one. Wherever you stood, you would see the whole network expanding away from you as though you were at the centre. So every point plays the role of centre. This, incidentally, was why the idea of an infinite universe was regarded as such a dangerous one back in 1600 when Giordano Bruno was burnt at the stake for supporting the idea of an infinite universe, contrary to Aristotle's teaching in the early Catholic Church. Why was the idea of an infinite universe so dangerous? Well, on the one hand, the Church wanted God to be the only infinity, but more importantly, there was not a single centre in that universe. So there wasn't a special, unique place where Earth and humanity could reside. The infinite universe, every place was special. Well, so much for the infinite universe case, but what about the finite universe? That seems to be much more awkward. If you just think of a two-dimensional universe, so like a flat sheet, you know, how is it possible for this to have no centre and no edge? This seems completely impossible. But it is if it's just flat. But suppose that your two-dimensional universe is curved like the surface of a ball or a balloon. Then now you can walk around like an ant on this spherical surface and you will never run into an edge. So again, there can be no boundary on a finite space, even though on a flat surface you would run into the edge. If you inflate your balloon here and you locate yourself on any one of these imaginary galaxies, you will see all the others move away from you as though you're at the centre of the expansion. And it doesn't matter which one you stand on, you will see the same uniform expansion. So again, even on a finite space, we can have this unusual situation of there being no boundary, no edge, and no centre to the expansion. In the real universe, you're moving up one dimension, and space would act in this finite case as though it's the three-dimensional boundary of some imaginary four-dimensional space. Well, the picture of the expanding universe that's gradually been built up, particularly since the mid-1960s, when radiation was discovered from the early apparently hot phase of the universe, which I'll mention in a moment, here's a picture which we'll see several times. It's some measure of the amount of expansion, the separation of those distant markers, and age or time in billions of years. And here's the trajectory mapping the expansion. And as in the sort of travel maps, you are here somewhere quite close to 14 billion years, 13.7 billion years after the apparent beginning of the expansion. And what the expanding universe brings you that's revolutionary and unusual and makes cosmology such a fascinating subject is that it means that the universe and the conditions within it are in a state of continuous change. So today the universe is rather cool. The radiation temperature is about 3 degrees above absolute zero. If you go back to when the universe is about 1,000 times more contracted, the radiation would be 1,000 times greater, 3,000 degrees. Too hot for atoms and simple molecules. There will be no planets, no stars, no structures like we see today. So the universe in the past was a much simpler place. When it's about 250,000 years old, at that high temperature, if we expand it forward, it cools off, first of all, enough for simple atoms of hydrogen to form, simple molecules of hydrogen follow, and then gradually some parts of the universe expanding on the average a little more slowly than others because they contain more material, start to gather more material to them, they slow down even more, and eventually they stop expanding and they turn around and condense and form what we ultimately call galaxies. Within them, stars form in complicated ways involving nuclear reactions and radiation processes. And we've gradually seen around hundreds upon hundreds of planets and even planetary systems around other stars. So we know the formation of planets is a generic process. It's not somehow unique to our solar system. But then somehow, at least on one of those solar systems, on one of the planets within it, we know that biochemistry has developed and evolved very rapidly into things like you and me. And we've no idea whether this is a process which has happened elsewhere, rarely or even commonly. Maybe one day we will. In the future, there's a sort of rather pessimistic long-range forecast that eventually the sun will exhaust its energy, all other stars will exhaust their energy and collapse to very dense remnants, and the environments needed for life as we understand it will have ended. And the universe will become a place which is rather bare of complexity, ever cooling, but ever expanding, perhaps. So in between, we live in this sort of habitable zone of cosmic history. After the stars have formed, so they can provide life-supporting environments, but before all the stars have died. And that's an interesting situation because the fact that it's some sense inevitable that we should be looking at the universe in this little niche of cosmic history biases in many ways how we find the universe to be and allows us to make some simple but I think interesting statements about the universe. So you might ask, well, why is the universe so old? You're talking about 14 billion years. The oldest stars are more than 10 billion years. Why these enormous periods of time? Well, these periods of time are intimately connected to ourselves and our own existence. The materials that make life of our sort possible, elements heavier than hydrogen and helium, don't appear ready-made in the universe or arise at its earliest state. They're formed in the stars, in the later stages of the evolution of stars, when stars implode and undergo dramatic periods of nuclear synthesis. And in those periods, helium and helium will combine to make beryllium, has a rather anomalously long lifetime that allows another helium nucleus to be captured to produce carbon. And there's an interesting coincidence that Hoyle noticed that makes this reaction resonant and relatively quick. Fortunately, the next reaction is not resonant, otherwise all the carbon nuclei would vanish rather quickly and be burnt into oxygen. So these are the key steps that make the biologically interesting elements, and in fact all the heavier ones as well. So if you're interested in silicon, if you're a computer officer and you think that life needs to be based on silicon, you can go further upstream. The silicon comes from the same type of process. But these processes take lots and lots of time. You need almost 10 billion years for these types of nuclear reactions to occur. And so you begin to see why it's no surprise that we find the universe to be so old. If you want to have the building blocks of complexity and life, you need those many billions of years of time to make the building blocks. And then we might ask, following from that, why is the universe so big? Why is it billions of light years across? Why are other stars and galaxies so far away? Because we need all that time to make building blocks of complexity that make you and I, and other things that we see, we know that we must have had 10 billion years of expansion. And because the universe is expanding, it's going to be expanding out to at least 10 billion light years in extent. You might have thought we could happily exist in a universe that was about as big as the Milky Way galaxy. Contains 100 billion stars, there's plenty of room there, lots of sight for life, but you would barely have been around for a month in a universe the size of the Milky Way galaxy. So there's barely enough time to pay off your credit card bill, let alone evolve complexity and life. So the enormous size of the universe is unusually connected to ourselves. We couldn't exist in a universe that was significantly smaller than the one we see. The other odd thing about the universe is that to a first approximation, it doesn't contain anything at all. It's just empty. If you were to take all the atoms in the universe and just space them out equally in an array, you would have, on the average, just one atom in every cubic meter of space. Now, it's not possible to make that good a vacuum in any laboratory on Earth. So this is an extraordinarily empty state of affairs. If we start gathering things together, this one atom in every cubic meter is like running into a lump the size of the Earth every 10 light years. And a star like the Sun every 100 or 10, or every 1,000 light years, and a galaxy like the Milky Way every 10 million light years. So the enormously low density of material in the universe is why the distances between cosmic structures are so great. And that low density, again, is a reflection of the enormous amount of expansion that there has been, the enormous age that the universe has. The other property of the universe that I always used to try and impress unsuccessfully upon our children, they're a bit younger, is the universe is cool, very cool. So today the radiation temperature is about 3 degrees above absolute zero. But if you have an expanding ball of gas, as you increase the diameter of the ball, the temperature will fall. And so the fact that the temperature is so low today is another reflection of the enormous amount of expansion and aging that there has been. One curious observation that you can make that's related to that is if you go outside, you will immediately notice that the sky is dark at night. This is not quite so obvious a feature of the universe as you might think. So just over 300 years ago, Edmund Halley, who first drew our attention to the comet that bears his name, first asked seriously the question, why is the sky dark at night? if you, like him, imagine that you're looking into a forest, then as you scan the forest, you just see this phalanx of tree trunks. Your line of sight everywhere ends on a tree trunk. And Halley imagined, well, if you look out into the universe of stars, he was wondering whether there were an infinity of stars, surely your line of sight everywhere should end on the surface of a star. Just like in the forest, with just a few hundred trees, it ends on a tree trunk. And so the whole of the sky should look like the surface of a star all the time. There should never be any night. But clearly that's not the case. It was not until the discovery of the expanding universe that this paradox, became known as Olbers paradox, as Olbers wrote about it rather later, was resolved. This low density in the universe today means that there just isn't enough energy in the universe to illuminate the sky. If we were to turn all the matter in the universe, that one atom in every cubic meter, into radiation just like that, using E equals MC squared, all that would happen is that the background radiation in the universe, instead of being 3 degrees above absolute zero, would be about 15 degrees above absolute zero. And you wouldn't notice, as long as you weren't some of the atoms that were being vaporized. But if you go back in time to when the universe was 1,000 times more contracted, then the temperature was 3,000 degrees and the whole sky was bright. So there was a time when the whole sky was bright, but it was when the universe was much younger and more contracted rather than today. Well, this little tour of these fundamental questions sort of led us to what seems sort of philosophically a rather topsy-turvy situation, in that we've seen that if you want the universe to be able to contain life-supporting building blocks of complexity of some sort, it's got to be almost empty, it's got to be big, it's got to be old, and it's got to be dark and it's got to be cold. So if you were a pre-1925 philosopher or philosopher of science, like Bertrand Russell, you would have thought that these sorts of properties were really antithetical to life-supporting environments. But because of this remarkable interplay between time and space and density and temperature, these are all consequences of the necessary conditions needed to give rise to the building blocks of complexity. Well, let's sort of start looking backwards in time to what the modern so-called Big Bang picture tells us about the early stages of the universe. So far, we've been talking about universes that are expanding, but universes are like your investments. They can go down as well as up. In fact, they can plummet. And there are universes which expand to a maximum and then can contract back to a big crunch, and there are ones that can run away here, and there are these sort of British compromise universes that are just exactly in between. Many, many years ago, I gave a lecture at her invitation to Margaret Thatcher at 10 Downing Street to some members of her cabinet on cosmology, and because of the situation, I was invited to go the day before to just do a little practice while they put the bulletproof glass in the room that was being used. And they said, can you just talk for 5 minutes about something you're going to talk about? And I remember mentioning this sort of British compromise universe here on a picture like this. And then after 5 minutes, the Prime Minister's advisor sort of stopped me and said, it's going fine. He said, that'll be all right. So I've just got one piece of advice. He said, when you come to mention that British universe, be much more upbeat. It's just the sort of thing the Prime Minister likes to hear about. So what's interesting about this picture is that if we look at our expansion trajectory today, it's tantalisingly close to that critical divide, the British compromise universe, as it were, that divides universes that expand forever from those that eventually collapse. These two scenarios have a very simple interpretation that Newton would have understood quite well. The if you try to launch a rocket from the Earth's surface, you've got to achieve a particular escape velocity, it's called, about 11 kilometres per second, to escape the Earth's pull and keep going into space. If I just throw this in the air at less than the escape velocity, it comes back. It's pulled back by the Earth's gravity. It has less than the launch speed required. So these universes, in effect, have less than that launch speed. These have more than the launch speed and will run away forever. And the compromised critical universe has exactly the critical escape speed. So the general interpretation of these scenarios is not that dissimilar to what we're used to on Earth. But the most interesting thing, if we look back again at this picture, as we try to reconstruct the past history of the universe, we're exploring environments that are much hotter and denser than we experience today. And back in the end of the 1940s, some American astronomers, led by George Gamow and then Ralph Alpha and Robert Hermann, realised that it ought to be possible to calculate some of the consequences of that environment. And they predicted, although not many people noticed, that there ought to be a heat radiation background in the universe left over from that hot early beginning. So it's like letting off a big bomb. If you come back later on, you should find some radiation fallout witnessing to that explosion. And almost 50 years ago, it'll be the 50th anniversary next year of the discovery of this radiation, which was made at Bell Telephone Laboratories at Holmdel, New Jersey, by Penzias and Wilson, another Nobel Prize winning experiment. And subsequently, those observations that they made really just at one frequency have been filled out into a rather beautiful overall spectrum of the radiation using observations from space, another Nobel Prize winning experiment from COBE. So this is the intensity in funny intensity units, and here is the frequency and the so-called Planck curve characteristic of pure heat radiation is traced by the solid bars, and the observational data from COBE is shown here. I should say that these little circles are not in any way attempts to represent the uncertainties of the observations. The measurement errors are so tiny, they're over 100 times smaller than the thinnest visible line that could be drawn on this picture. So this is the most perfect example of heat radiation ever observed in nature. There are no distortions so far found in this spectrum. So this type of spectrum can't be produced by radiation produced locally or after the universe has been a quarter of a million years in expansion. So this is radiation that's come from conditions hot enough and dense enough to relax it into this beautiful equilibrium spectrum. Well, the expansion of the universe and those properties that we've seen there are sort of three rather unusual puzzles about the universe, which came to a head in around 1980, that if you listed the key problems in cosmology, it would have been, why is the expansion so close to that critical divide I alluded to? You know, why is the universe expanding so close to the escape velocity? Why is the expansion the same in every direction? So to an accuracy measured then of one part in 1,000, but today it's an accuracy of about two parts in 100,000. And thirdly, where do all the lumps and bumps come from that turn into galaxies and stars? The universe is not perfectly smooth. Where do the little irregularities come from that eventually turn into stars and galaxies? This was a great puzzle. If galaxies didn't exist, astronomers wouldn't have had any difficulty explaining the fact. So it was not easy to explain where galaxies had come from. But then in 1981, a new idea came on the scene in cosmology, which has really become a type of standard model in the subject. And I'll try and explain it as simply as possible. The idea was that here's our size-time picture that we've been looking at. We go right back near to the beginning. This is a tiny fraction of a second, 10 to the minus 35. The idea of inflation was that there's just a brief interlude of expansion where the expansion starts to accelerate. So when it's curving over in this direction, the expansion is decelerating, because the only force acting is gravity of other stuff, always tending to slow it down. So the hypothesis was that there's a brief interlude of acceleration, or inflation, as it was called, to reflect the economic fascinations of the time. What this does, you can see from this picture, that if inflation hadn't occurred, the expansion would sort of gone on this track. But after inflation, the universe is much more expanded, much bigger, if you like, at this time than it would otherwise have been. And it is pushed much more closely to that critical divide. And so a very short interlude of this inflation is able to drive the expansion so fantastically close to the critical divide that even 10 billion years later, you would not be able to discern any deviation. The other thing that it does is to make the expansion go at the same rate in every direction. So this problem of why is the expansion so isotropic, same in every direction, a short interlude of this accelerated expansion drives all directions to go essentially at the same rate. But what about our third question? This is really the same idea, but in a different picture. Here we are, sitting here, and how far can we see with a perfect telescope? Well, let's suppose the expansion has been 14 billion years. Get about curved space effects, and we can look maybe 14 billion light years. And we call that the visible universe. There's lots more universe beyond that horizon, but that's what we can see. And we could now run it backwards, okay, into the past, and examine at any time how small it would have been at some early time. Well, if you don't have that accelerated expansion, at any given time in the past, the universe is not really terribly small in the sense that it is not small enough for light signals to travel across it in the time that's transpired since the beginning. So it's a bit of a mystery why one side of it looks the same as the other side. You know, can't talk to different sides by sending light signals or radiation. But if you have that accelerated expansion, the universe gets bigger so much more quickly that you can grow a whole visible universe today from a region that is much, much smaller at an early time. So small that it's easily possible for light to travel from one side to the other and make it coordinated and extremely smooth. So a region of this size at 10 to the minus 35 of a second allows light to travel all the way across, and that becomes, when it's expanded, a region that encompasses at least all our visible universe today. So this would give you an explanation as to why, on the average, you expect conditions on one side of the universe to be rather similar to those on another side of the universe. They're all inherited from the same blueprint. But then soon people realised there was an even more interesting conclusion to draw. That this early region could not be perfectly smooth. There must always be some quantum fluctuations, some statistical fluctuations, which are finite. And it's possible to calculate what they should be. And when the acceleration takes place, they get stretched in wavelength as well. And they manifest themselves as variations on the size of the visible universe today in that radiation temperature that we see. So what they are little changes in the density of material. They're little seeds which will eventually accrete more material, become gravitationally more pronounced, and turn into the galaxies and stars that we see later on. So all of a sudden you had a mechanism by which you could make the seeds out of which the large-scale structure in the universe could grow. More important still, you could calculate the spectrum of these fluctuations and predict what the effect should be on the radiation. And there have been a number of satellite missions every 10 years or so. There seems to be another one. This is the most recent one, where the theory group are in Cambridge, in our department, Dampton, the Institute of Astronomy, and this is the type of map that's produced by having your satellite look at every part of the sky over and over again and produce a complete map of the temperature variations of different scales on the sky. So the red orangey regions are a little bit above the average by a few hundred thousandths of a degree, and then the blue regions are a little below the average. And if you're a statistician and you look at this, you may stare at it and wonder whether it's a completely statistical random process or not. Better to do a more sophisticated analysis of different aspects one at a time. At the top is one particular analysis that's called the power spectrum. So you're looking at the variations in temperature or in colour on this map as you go from place to place. So suppose that you look on the sky over there, you measure the temperature, and then you measure the temperature 1 degree away. So twice the size of the full moon, and then you repeat that for every 1 degree pair of separations over the entire sky, and then you average. And you put the answer on this picture just there. So this picture shows you various data points. The solid curve is the prediction of a standard one of these inflationary models that's lifted so that it matches the points sort of here, and then you check indeed that there's a rather beautiful fit all the way down to smaller and smaller and smaller scales. So this moving picture here shows you when you go past 100 with this block, this shows you what the resolution would be needed on a map to be able to tell what's going on. So this, I think, I find very convincing evidence that something like inflation happened in the early universe, that we do indeed have direct observational evidence that there was a period of this accelerated expansion. Why is this so interesting to cosmologists? Why do they keep spending huge sums of money to go to map this radiation in greater and greater detail? This particular power spectrum, as well as other similar graphs, contains a mountain of information. The location and the height of each of these peaks tells you important things about the properties of the universe, how close it is to that critical divide, how much material it contains, how much dark material, and so on. So here's an example of some animations. So in this case, you have a model, and you keep changing the amount of visible matter in the universe. So the things in stars, ordinary stuff out of which you and I are made. And what this shows you is how changing that number within the range of variation that direct observations allow produces a rather different shape to that power spectrum. So by observing it in detail, you do have very precise limits on this type of parameter. And over here, what happens if the dark material in the universe, so material that we don't believe is made out of ordinary stuff like you and me, but is made out of some new type of neutrino-like matter, which it's expected that the Large Hadron Collider may shed some light on the next time it runs in a year's time. And again, as you change the amount of that material in the universe, the pattern of these peaks, the heights of the peaks, changes. So by observing that power spectrum in very great detail, you can unpick new constraints and limits and values for all sorts of properties of the universe. It's a very sensitive indicator of those features. Well, a few months ago, you probably read the newspapers, that there was great excitement that an observation not very far from here at the South Pole claimed to have discovered evidence for a different type of signal. So the observations we were just looking at are created by variations in ordinary types of matter, variations from place to place in its density. But when inflation occurs, there will also be variations in what are called gravitational waves. So these are like tidal forces. So if a gravitational wave sort of went through this screen at this moment as it approached, it would stretch the screen in one direction and compress it in the other, just like a tidal force, without changing its area. And the claim from the so-called BICEP2 experiment, run, I think, primarily from Princeton, was that they had found characteristic variations in the background radiation by observing a rather small patch of the sky. So this is not like Planck. It's looking at a particular patch of the sky and just at one frequency. So they have greater sensitivity by nearly a factor of 10 because of that focus. And they claimed that they found these characteristic twisting patterns which were predicted and expected to arise in the radiation polarization if the scattering of photons was affected by gravitational waves produced at inflation. This would be a very great discovery indeed, discovering not only gravitational waves from something other than colliding objects, but radiation right from the beginning of inflation and the beginning of the universe. Since then, there's been rather intense scrutiny of this claim, and I think everyone has agreed, both the discoverers of BICEP and people on Planck and WMAP, that it'll be a few months before we know if they have really made that discovery. And the reason is because the type of signal that they see can be mimicked by the production, by the effects of dust in our own galaxy. So when the radiation from the background comes through our galaxy, it can have imprinted upon it a signal of that same polarizing sort by interactions with dust. It's a good example of why sort of the Popperian philosophy of science is not really an adequate or sensible one. Observations don't falsify theories, because observations can be wrong. And so you don't know if they're right or wrong, and you don't know if there's some type of bias in the experimental evidence that you're gaining. And so you need to understand all those things before you know whether an observation has really changed the likelihood of a theory being correct. So this is a nice example of science in action. By October, the Planck team in Cambridge and elsewhere are planning to publish a detailed dust map of the sky, which they have in their data sets, which will show whether the region of sky observed by BICEP is significantly dusty. If it was, there is no evidence for gravitational wave presence in their data. But if it's not dusty, then there will be. This is an old Planck dust map, which was produced before the BICEP observations, which shows a sort of dust profile around the sky. And there are some regions of the map which are empty. And unfortunately, one of those regions contains the BICEP region. Okay, so I say this was published long ago before BICEP, but in October, these much more interesting regions down here, the South Pole, will appear. So this little dilemma about whether gravitational waves have really been seen or not is not something that's going to go on forever. We hope this will be resolved at some level in October. What is also required are further observations at different frequencies so that you can tell whether the polarizing signal has a frequency-dependent characteristic, like intervening dust, or whether it is frequency-independent, as might be expected in the cosmological scenario. Well, so much for BICEP. One or two more philosophical things that one can say about inflation. After that first sort of vanilla-flavoured inflation model was proposed, people then gradually realised that there were various almost unwanted and peculiar consequences of this scenario. The first is something called chaotic inflation. And what it teaches you is that geography is a much more complicated subject than when you were at school. So if we imagine there's that little fluctuation back near the beginning of the universe that accelerates and ultimately becomes sufficiently large that it becomes old enough and big enough for stars to form and complexity and us to arise. So this would be the history of our little patch. But of course the whole universe may be infinite or at least extraordinarily large. And there will be many other of these little causally connected bubble-sized regions, and they will all inflate in some random way by different amounts. Some might not inflate by very much at all, some by a lot. And so it's like having a foam of bubbles that's randomly heated. Some bubbles expand a lot and some not very much. And so you can see that if we were able to see beyond our horizon today, we positively predict that we expect that ultimately the universe will be found to be very, very different in structure, certainly in density and temperature and expansion, and maybe in all sorts of other rather fundamental respects. So some theoretical versions of this might even have different numbers of fundamental forces or different values of constants of nature if one goes far enough. So this is not that strange an idea. There have always been philosophical speculations that you can't be sure that the universe is the same if you go far enough to what it is today. But I think it's the first time there's been a positive prediction that we should expect that to be the case. So it's not just a sort of rather negative possibility, sort of overly positivistic philosophical reflection. Well, if it wasn't bad enough that geography is more complicated when you're at school, it seems that history is more complicated than at school too. Because just as we can't see any reason why there shouldn't be that spatial complexity in the inflationary universe, Alex Valenkin and Andre Linde pointed out that it appears inevitable that you have a sort of complexity in time. That if one of these bubbles were to inflate and produce a large region, then this tends to automatically create within the region the conditions needed for it to undergo further inflation and for the results of that further inflation to inflate again. So it's an eternal self-reproducing, in fact, fractal process. And we therefore locate ourselves in one of these inflated, expanded bubbles. And if we ask a fundamental question like, did the universe have a beginning? There's now a rather nuanced answer. Our fluctuation indeed appears to have some sort of beginning, whether it's in a quantum fluctuation or something else. But the entire process, the entire self-reproducing process, need not have a beginning, certainly not a beginning in the same sense. So we find ourselves positioned somewhere in this apparently continually self-reproducing process that's sometimes known by the name of the multiverse. And I stress this was not really a picture that people went out looking for. It just seems to be forced upon you as an unavoidable consequence of the instability of space to continually undergo this type of inflationary behaviour. The reason the idea of inflation was proposed by Alan Guth in 1981 was not entirely ad hoc. So the cause of this accelerated expansion needs to be a form of matter which anti-gravitates because it has sufficient negative pressure or tension. And in elementary particle physics at that time, new theories were finding that this type of matter was generally present in all sorts of theories of what happened at very, very high energy. So the idea was to perhaps explore what would be the consequences if such forms of matter appear at very, very high energy. And their effect would be to start this inflation. It's expected that these forms of matter would be unstable. So they would soon decay away and the inflation would end. So that's why there is a short interlude of this behaviour. Well, let's end by just asking some questions about the end of the universe. Okay, is the universe going to expand forever? In some level, this is a rather moot point. There's usually someone at the back that when you say the universe is going to come to an end in 200 billion years, they say, I was worried for a moment. I thought you said million years. But you don't need to worry about the long-term future of the universe in some sense, that things are bad enough in the solar system. So the sun has a life cycle. We are about 4.6 billion years into that cycle. But after about 10 billion years, the sun is going to have a serious energy crisis. It's going to expand dramatically into a red giant phase. and then it's going to implode to a size down about that of the Earth, 100 times smaller, but considerably more massive than the Earth, a million times more massive. And this final state, so-called white dwarf phase, will just continue to cool into a glowing cinder, getting cooler and cooler, perhaps forever, gradually evaporating nuclei and other particles from the surface. Here's a Hubble Space Telescope picture of this type of process that gives rise to what's called a planetary nebula, even though it's got nothing to do with planets, just for historic reasons. This is a rather complicated one. You've got two of these rings of material being blown out. Perhaps there were two stars in this system, or there's a complicated magnetic field. So we can see stars dying in this spectacular fashion in many, many places within the galaxy. So this is the sort of intermediate range forecast if humanity on Earth wants to survive this long process where temperatures will change significantly as a result of stellar evolution, needs to go elsewhere. But the long-range forecast for the universe changed about 13 or 14 years ago. The picture of a universe that expands and then collapses or runs away in expansion was changed because of a discovery, new techniques of observation that were able to extend the search for Hubble's law further than ever before in a reliable way. And what they discovered was that the expansion eventually starts to speed up. It's as though the universe is inflating again. Although we can't see any connection between the acceleration of inflation early on and the acceleration that we see today. So the universe began with its radiation and ordinary material, and then a few billion years ago it starts to change gear and start to accelerate. This happens when the universe is expanded to about three quarters, 75%, of its present extent. This process requires the existence of a type of anti-gravitating material in the universe, and there are different other sources of evidence for its existence. So we don't only have to rely on these Hubble-like observations of supernovae at great distances. Even the background radiation that we looked at witnesses to the presence of this so-called dark energy. So here's our picture again, and just focus on the light blue curve. If you change the amount of this dark energy in the universe, then this alters that power spectrum shape a maximum, again, in a quite sensitive way. The other picture is what happens if you change our expansion speed, how close we are to that critical value. So again, scrutiny of that spectrum allows you to find independent ways of placing constraints on that type of activity. Well, what do you see from these observations? The amount of material that there is in the universe in this anti-gravitating form that we call dark energy, whose exact identity is not known, it's not detected, as it were, locally, can't see it in the laboratory, it interacts too weakly. About 68% of all the energy in the universe is in that form. And of the rest, a little less than 5% is in the form that makes you and me. So ordinary protons and atoms and molecules, material in stars and clusters and interstellar medium. The rest we know is there and we call it dark matter. We can't see it because it doesn't shine in the dark. I mean, it could be dark stars and rubble and rocks and meteorites, but we don't think it is, because if it was, it would have other consequences that we don't see. So the belief is that this material must be stuff which doesn't take part in ordinary electromagnetic interactions like atoms. It has to be neutrino-like, feeling weak radioactive interactions and gravity only. And the prime candidate for this material is something that's sometimes called the WIMP, a weakly interacting massive particle. In effect, a new type of neutrino-like particle that's maybe 30 or 40 times more massive than a hydrogen atom. And the next great quest for the Large Hadron Collider in CERN is to achieve energies great enough to make these particles in great profusion. They're expected that they would be the lightest supersymmetric particles. Such particles have not been seen before. So there's a double challenge for the Large Hadron Collider to discover supersymmetry and also thereby to discover the identity of the lightest supersymmetric particle, the easiest one to make, and to see whether it fits the calculations to provide the right density of stuff to explain this material here. We know it's there. How do we know that? Because its presence affects the motion of the luminous material, determines the gravitational field within galaxies and in clusters, and everything in those systems moves as though there is present this other dark material providing its gravitational field. The identity of the dark energy is really the greatest unsolved problem in cosmology and in particle physics. I won't say any more about it. Perhaps it'll be solved by a particle physicist. Perhaps its identity will be first found by a cosmologist. But I sort of suspect this identity will be found by someone who is currently very, very young, maybe one of the people taking part in the Maths Olympiad this week. I think it will be the problem will be solved by someone of whom you have not yet heard. So if you're a young mathematics student or a young physics student, the challenge you have for the future is to explain the identity of the dark energy of in the universe, and in particular to explain why it's present in the very peculiar abundance that we find it to be present today. So thank you very much for listening. I hope I've given you some perspective on the universe. Here is a famous sort of perspective slide to leave you with that NASA produced, a universe that begins in some event, perhaps quantum mechanical or of a sort we don't yet know. It surges in expansion in those first moments by a process we've come to call inflation, which leaves imprints in the radiation in the universe that we can see even today. And so test whether that happened. And then as the universe starts to cool down and material starts to cluster, galaxies and stars start to form and produce the environments we see today. But then as a sting in the tail, in the relatively recent past, that process is stopped by the fact that the universe starts to accelerate. If the universe had started to accelerate earlier, there wouldn't be any stars and galaxies in the universe at all. Because once the acceleration begins, the formation of structure comes to an end. It just can't compete with the acceleration, pulling material away. So all this leads to this rather comforting picture of the sky that we see out of the window or through our telescope. Thank you.
But we will take questions, a few. So if you have anything you want. There is a mic coming in, actually.
If you say the universe has got a beginning and the end is going to go into oblivion, what is the real purpose of it all? And how do we... as human beings, studying, doing all this studying and getting all this knowledge, what does it help us? Is it all going to end?
If we go back to this picture, we saw early on there were two types of end. So one was the end of indefinite expansion, another was the end of the Big Crunch. The observational situation we have at the moment from the amount of dark energy that we see is that the universe is very far from heading towards a big crunch. It's headed towards an indefinite accelerated expansion. And in fact, things are even worse than you suggest. Because what this acceleration does is that it creates a situation where, in effect, we're inside a black hole. And there's a limit to how far that we can see, ultimately. So as time goes on, our successors, when they try to do cosmology millions of years in the future, will find themselves confined within a region which they can't see beyond, as though they're inside a black hole. And eventually, the last of the external galaxies will pass out through that horizon. And astronomers will not be able to see other galaxies anymore. And if you were just coming on the scene in the universe at that time, you would never know there was an expanding universe. You will never know that there are other galaxies. You will not be able to measure this radiation background anymore because it won't be able to penetrate our galaxy. The plasma frequency will no longer be conducive. So we not only live in a period of cosmic history where things are quite good if you want to evolve living complexity, but if you want to do cosmology, it's quite a good period as well. So in answer to your other question, I don't know the answer is, you know. But even before scientific cosmology, I mean, few religions, and certainly not Christian religions, had a perspective that life went on forever in the universe. So it's not exactly a new idea. So I don't know the answer to your second question. Many years ago, somebody got in a taxi in London, and this was in the 1930s, I think, and he had a very talkative taxi driver. And the taxi driver said to him, "You know, I had that Lord Russell in the taxi just now." And I said to him, "Lord Russell, what's it all about then? And do you know, he couldn't tell me."
Good evening. Thank you for the wonderful talk. My question is based on the inevitable expansion of the sun. I recognize that the Mayans predicted a winged disk, which is Planet X or Nebula or Nibiru. Were they predicting that expansion of the sun to it being exploding, or is it another planet that we're actually predicted in the universe that will come as the winged disk?
I missed who you said had predicted.
By the Mayans.
I don't know. What's interesting about this picture is, you know, there is a sort of global warming, as it were, and it's important to point out that this has got nothing to do with global warming that you read about in the newspapers today. Okay, so this is not a change in climate on Earth as a result of man-made activity. It's a result that would be produced by this rather catastrophic evolution of the sun. So nobody thousands of years ago was able to sort of predict what's going to happen to the sun over huge periods of time, and not able to see other stars in such a way that would allow them to join together the life history of the sun.
Last question. Going one.
Thank you. Thanks for a super talk. Your recipe for life slide, you were talking about combining helium to make beryllium, and then beryllium combining with helium for carbon and so on. Has that been done outside of nature and laboratory? Can that be done?
Well, these nuclear reactions. These are the simplest nuclear reactions in some way. But if you make a nuclear bomb, for example, then you're dealing, with hydrogen fusion, not with helium. So you don't simulate that reaction. Atomic bomb starts with something that's very large nucleus and breaks it up. So attempts to do, to have a fusion reactor based upon these interactions, is dealing with hydrogen. Hydrogen And what's difficult about that, of course, is maintaining the stability of the reactor over a long period of time. So for decades, people have tried to make a controlled nuclear reactor, and it requires very complicated configurations of magnetic field to try to hold the configurations stably over long periods of time. It's what's sometimes called tokamak configuration that Russian theorists long ago developed. So you can't simulate these nuclear reactions directly on Earth. There are some interesting pieces of evidence for historic nuclear reactions on Earth. So 2 billion years ago, in Africa, actually, in Oklo, which is up in Gambia, we know that a natural nuclear reactor ran. So unusual geophysical conditions under the Earth produced sort of intermittent nuclear reactions involving samarium. And you can see the results there of that process, where there are uranium mines today. And many years ago now, in the 70s, this remarkable discovery was made that there was unexpected depletion of certain isotopes. And at first, the French scientists involved in this and members of their government thought that material was being stolen en route to the French sort of nuclear reactors. But then it was realised that there had been this depletion and a nuclear reactor had run under natural conditions. So inclined slate had made material run down and become compressed. Nuclear reactions would begin. Liquids and steam would be produced, which turned the reactor off. It would then cool down and become hotter again as it condensed. And so it would just run and stop, run and stop. And this has been a great indicator for fundamental physics, because the particular reactions that run there rely on a remarkable coincidence between values of different constants of nature. And so we know that remarkable coincidence was in place 1.8 billion years ago. It's in place today. So you have a way of constraining whether physics could have changed the value of a constant of nature over 2 billion years. So that's a rather beautiful example of a natural nuclear process that's taken place on Earth in Africa.
No less. Thank you very much. Thank you. We have
a book. Brilliant. Okay. Brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we have a reception.
Yes, that's what I heard. Yes. Drinks and things, yeah.
Yeah.